As David said, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 1. One of the last times that I spoke on Acts 17. And I was talking about Paul and his witness in Athens and how he had to deal with certain types of people who had a glimpse of who God was, but they didn't know the true God. They believed in what we would typically say is an evolutionary understanding. They had multiple gods. They had multiple images. They just did not have a full understanding of who God was. And we looked at the book of Acts chapter 17, and we talked about that, and we went through those things of why Paul started from creation and why he laid a firm foundation, and then he began to preach Christ as Lord and as Savior. But he laid a firm foundation first. Another example in the Scriptures of laying a firm foundation is Luke chapter 24, and it's the familiar story of the stranger on the road to Emmaus, how the two disciples are walking down the road, and then all of a sudden this stranger appears to them, and they start talking, and they have a conversation, and it says that the stranger started to expound to them concerning Moses and the prophets. Well, he started from Moses' writings, which, and we're going to talk about this tonight, the first book of Moses, which is the book of Genesis, and we're going to look at that. When we look at our society, we see it as a post-Christian nation. I don't believe that we are a Christian nation anymore. I believe that at one time we were founded upon Christian principles, but I do not believe that we are anymore, simply because of the things that I see within my daily life. And a lot of us who attended public school, we definitely saw that, especially as the teachers. We have seen all of these things that are coming into our society. We're forgetting about God. We could care less about God. Who is God? Is He just a life force? Is He just a feeling in our bosom? Is He just a thought that passes by? Who is this God that everybody, that all these Christians talk about? And a lot of these people who have not grown up in a Christian home, they do not know who the true God is. They just think God is, like some people who will tell me, He's just a man upstairs. Well, who's the man upstairs? And then they can't go any further than that. They don't know who this one true God is. So I'd like to start with Genesis chapter 1. And I'm going to go through the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Not tonight. I don't think we have enough time for that. But we're going to see how many verses we get through, and we're just going to look at them. And we're going to start off with the foundation of why Genesis is so important to our faith as believers. What makes Genesis unique in every aspect of who we are as Christians? And the authorship is attributed to Moses. I don't know whether he really actually wrote the book or if he just compiled all of the letters that were written by, say, Adam or, say, Seth, or he just compiled all of them together through the years. We're not sure. Most of the scholars would say that Moses is the one who brought it all together, but whether he wrote all of it or not, we're not sure about that. The estimated time concerning when it was written, most people will say between 1406 and 1446 B.C., so it's roughly about not quite 6,000 years ago when it was probably penned. Genesis means simply origin or beginning. The book of Genesis is the foundation book on which all of the vital doctrines of Christianity stand. These first 11 chapters bring forth the origin of such things as life, religion, marriage, evil, sin, salvation. All of these concepts that we as believers understand, this is where it came from. If you take out the first 11 chapters of Genesis, none of the other doctrines that we have make sense. They're all founded upon these chapters right here, especially concerning sin and salvation and these issues that we're going to be dealing with as we go through these first 11 chapters. Let's go ahead and begin with Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. King James renders it heaven, singular. It can be rendered both plural, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, why it can be plural or it can be singular. Let's start with the first part of it. In the beginning, God, the Hebrew is Elohim, a uniplural noun. And this is going to be one of those things that if you're not a Hebrew scholar, you're not going to fully understand. Thereby, if I tell you, you're not going to understand because I'm not a Hebrew scholar. It basically means it is a plural noun with a singular meaning. Sometimes it can be rendered, and the Hebrew language is one of those that's very hard to understand because it doesn't have as many words as our language has. So you have to go with what the context says. So Elohim in this context is it's meaning a singular person, but it has a plural understanding. One of the other scriptures would say the gods, lowercase g, with an s at the end of it, which means plural, is the same Elohim. Depending on the context, that's how we're going to use these scriptures, these Hebrew scriptures. So Elohim is a uniplural noun, and it's basically representing for us as Christians what the Trinity is. It's representing this transcendent God who goes before everything. He's eternal. He's outside of time. And he's the great one true God. So this is what it's talking about when it's speaking of Elohim. And it's referring to the Godhead. In the beginning, let's take beginning. God is outside of time. For us to comprehend God, he has to come into time. He has to make time for us. Him being eternal, it's hard for us to fathom that magnitude of who God is, that he has always existed before there was time. Even he's never going to end. He's just always there. He's right here, and he's right here at the same time. He sees everything happening at one time. We can only relate to God within our structure of time, looking at the clock. That's how we relate to God. But God relates to us outside of time. He comes into time so that he can deal with mankind and with his creation. So God, in the beginning, he created the heavens and the earth. Created means to form from nothing. I'm going to give you two words. One's Latin and one's Hebrew. Ex nihilo. Probably some of you have probably heard about that as far as it's been a magazine, and I think it was also a video. And it's basically meaning from nothing. God created from nothing. He didn't need anything as far as matter. He didn't need anything as far as particles. He just made things. He just created things out of nothing. It could better be translated ek theos. And basically that's meaning from God. So God takes nothing and he forms everything that we're going to be talking about tonight. And again, we're not going to get through all 11 chapters of that. We'll get through chapter 1. Let's look at something else. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let's look at heavens real quick. In the King James, it's translated heaven singular. And then the New King James, which is what I'm reading from, is translated heavens plural. The Hebrew actually means it could be, depending on context, again, it could be singular or plural. In this context, I believe it means plural, representing all of the heavens that we know about. There is a heavens that we see when we look outside. We see our sky, our clouds. Right now, probably lightning and rain coming down. But we see those in our heaven. Then there's the heaven that is beyond that, which is what we call outer space. And then we have one more realm of heaven, which we do not see. And that's what Paul considered the third heaven, which he was called up to. So we see the aspect, what is referring to right here, is probably the two heavens that we can see and not necessarily the heavens that we cannot see. The expanse of space could mean the basic components of space or visible space. Now let's go to Earth. When we think about Earth, we think about this planet that we're on right now. Basically, what it means is matter. It means land. And it could just mean the basic components of matter. It could just mean the particles that God speaks into existence, not necessarily the Earth that we see today. In this first verse, we're seeing three concepts that are the basic understandings of science. We see beginning, which is time. We see space, which is the heavens being formed, and we see earth or matter. So we have time, space, and matter, the things that are needed for life to exist. And God's going to form these things into his mighty creation. Let's turn to Psalm 33, verse 6. And these verses are just going to emphasize God's majesty and power in creation. Verse 6, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Now let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 12. Verse 12, he has made the earth by his power, he has established the world by his wisdom. He has stretched out the heavens at his discretion. In John chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, which are very familiar verses. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. In Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. And these are just emphasizing God's creative power, Him alone being the Creator. Verse 16, For by Him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and in Him all things consist. And the last verse, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 10. And You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of Your hands. So again, this is just emphasizing what God has done on this very first foundational verse of the whole of Scripture. You take out this verse, and we have a limited understanding of who God is. We leave this verse in here, and we see that God is the all-present, all-knowing, all-powerful God who created all that is and that it ever will be. So with this verse, it is vitally important to the rest of the book of Genesis and also to our Christian foundation and what we understand today. Henry Morris, I know a lot of you probably know who he is or who he was. He said of this first verse, and basically this verse is just saying God. It's not explaining that how God got here. It's not explaining, well, you should believe in a God. It's just simply stating a fact that God in the beginning. And this is a fascinating thing compared to all the other religions that are out there. They try and describe how their God came out to be. Muhammad was born of such and such, he lived such and such, he died such and such. Buddha the same thing, Confucius, all of these other religious entities, all of them have a beginning. And then our scriptures tell us in the beginning God. And speaking of God not being started in the beginning, but He was outside of the beginning, He put the beginning into thought. So this is distinguishing the Judeo-Christian God from all of these other deities that are out there. And if you remember what we discussed in Acts 17, that is what Paul was up against. He was up against all these other deities, and he had to basically give them a foundational understanding of who God was. But Henry Morris says this, "This one verse refutes all of man's false philosophies concerning the origin and meaning of the world. Atheism, the universe was created by God. Pantheism, God is transcendent to that which He created. Polytheism, one God created all things. Materialism, matter had a beginning. Dualism, God was alone when He created. Humanism, God, not man, is the ultimate reality. And evolutionism, God created all things." So basically, this one verse destroys every foundation of any religion that is outside of Christianity because they have no foundation to stand on. We stand upon God's written word. They stand upon their thoughts, their feelings, their stories that they have written down. Before we get into verse 2, I want to take a little sidestep and deal with an issue called the gap theory. How many of you have heard about the gap theory? Okay. I'm using C.I. Schofield's Study Bible. How many of you have one of those? Okay, so you can follow along as I read these notes that he's written. The gap theory is basically teaching that between Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2 was a pause in which God judged Satan, cast him out of heaven, cast him upon the earth, and there was a judgment upon the earth, and that's where all the fossils come from. So between Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 1 verse 1 and Genesis chapter 1 verse 2, there is a time lapse. It could be millions of years. It could be even billions of years. We're unsure if we take the stance of the gap theory. So basically they're taking the teachings of evolution and they're putting them inside of the scriptures. And I'm going to talk about that tonight, why that is not a good idea. Some people may think it's an okay thing. C.I. Schofield did and many other people do. But I'm of the persuasion that it is not a good idea. So let's just read some of his notes concerning Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1 and verse 2. The second note says, the first creative act refers to the dateless past and gives scope for all the geologic ages. He references Jeremiah chapter 4 and Isaiah chapter 24, clearly indicate that the earth had undergone a cataclysmic change as a result of a divine judgment. The face of the earth bears everywhere the marks of such a catastrophe. Now, I agree with him that there are marks of a catastrophe, definitely. I just don't believe that it's between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. There are not wanting intimations which connect it with a previous testing and fall of angels. Let's see what else he says. Now he's speaking about creation. Note number 4, neither here nor in verses 14 through 18 is an original creative act implied. A different word is used. The sense is made to appear, made visible. The sun and moon were created in the beginning. The light, of course, came from the sun. Now I'm reading a little bit ahead, but this is trying to go along with the gap theory. But the vapor diffused the light. Later the sun appeared in an unclouded sky. There was another one that I wanted to read real quick. Okay. On page 4, I don't know if this is going to be the same as the study Bibles that you have. The word day, he's dealing with the word day, but I'm going to jump on down. It is by no means necessary to suppose that the life germ of seeds perished in the catastrophic judgment which overthrew the primitive order. With the restoration of dry land and light, the earth would bring forth as described. And he's referring to this pause. It was animal life which perished, the traces of which remain as fossils. Relegate fossils to the primitive creation and no conflict of science with the Genesis cosmogony remains. So he's basically saying if you put the fossils right there between verse 1 and verse 2, there's no issue between science and between what scientists would call religion. I don't think I would agree with that. Basically, when did death first occur? Somebody want to just answer that real quick? When Adam sinned. So, he would have to basically say that the death that we see now is basically a spiritual death, and it's not really a physical death, because physical death, I believe, took place after Adam's sin. If physical death has always existed and it happened during this judgment time, then we have a problem with the rest of the scriptures. We have to align Genesis chapter 1, this gap theory, with all the rest of scriptures. And when he jumps to Isaiah and to Jeremiah, you have to twist those scriptures to get the gap theory to get back into line with the scriptures. If you take evolution out of the context, if you take evolution out of biblical thought, you don't have to have a gap theory. If you put evolution within the scriptures, you have to have a gap theory. If you don't like the gap theory, then we're going to talk about at least two more ways that we can put these long ages into the scriptures. But basically, the gap theory is saying we see the fossil record. We're believers. We believe that the scriptures are speaking about sin, of life, of death, of cursing. We believe all of this, so we have to fit these fossil records, because the scientists, remember, they're saying that the fossils are thousands, millions of years. I mean, they're old bones. So we have to fit those within this timeline. We can't put the fossils between Genesis chapter 2 and chapter 4 because we're going to have these days mixed up. And some people do try and do that, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. But the gap theory is basically taking all of the fossil record and putting it between verse 1 and verse 2. And this is telling us that physical death has always existed. It's okay. Spiritual death is what the issue is. But we have to deal with, and we're going to talk about that in Genesis chapter 2 and chapter 3, what God was talking about when he said, in the day that you eat of it, you're going to die. Was he just talking about a spiritual death, or was he talking about something more catastrophic than that? And we'll see that in the coming chapters. All right, let's go on. Just to recap on the gap theory, I do not believe it's biblical. C.I. Schofield, as far as I know, was a godly man, a believer. Gave us a lot of good notes within his study Bible, but I believe he was in grave error when he was teaching the gap theory. And he didn't start the gap theory, neither. It's been out for years, even way before he came around. But we have to deal with these things in context. All right, let's go to Isaiah 45. Well, let's read Genesis chapter 1, verse 2 first. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Let's take without form and void. C.I. Scofield believes that this should be translated, the word was should be translated became. So, before this gap occurred, it had form, it had unity. And then when the gap happened, when the judgment of God came on the devil and he was cast down, and then the judgment on the earth happened, then you have this chaotic form. The earth is no longer in being unified. Now it's formless, and now it's without shape, and it's void of life. There's only one problem with that. If we change was to became, the earth was, or the earth became without form and void. The only issue is, in all the English versions of the scriptures, nobody translates was as became. So, if it should have been translated became, then at least one Bible interpreter would have gotten that right. And no English version, which is what we have to go by, translates was into became in this particular instance. Now, in other instances, that may be true, but in this instance, no other version, even his version, does not, his study Bible does not translate it to became. He puts a footnote at the bottom of it. So if we say it became, then we have room for the gap theory. If we say it was, as in without form and void, does not mean chaotic. Does not have to mean chaotic. It does not have to mean run amok. It can simply mean unformed or formless and void, which is the simple understanding of it. Darkness doesn't always represent evil. It can mean absence of light. A lot of times when we hear of darkness as believers, we always emphasize spiritual darkness as being negative, being evil, being the domain of the devil. Now let's turn to Isaiah 45, verse 7. So this is God speaking. I form the light and create the darkness. And then he goes on and he talks about some other things that he does, but I want to just emphasize the first part of the verse. I form the light and I create the darkness. So we would say when God creates, especially within the confines of Genesis chapter 1, that it's not evil, but what God says is it is good. And then when he ends chapter 1, he says it is very good. The darkness existed, but it doesn't mean that it's wrong or that it's negative or that it's bad. It's just simply saying that it's the absence of light within this context. Let's look at the Spirit of God. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So we're seeing the third person of the Trinity being mentioned. This sometimes in some of the versions is translated as breath. And it can be translated as breath, but you have to go with the context of what it's talking about. And this is speaking of a person, because breath can't really hover, not that I know of, but a spirit can hover or move. You can translate this as energize the waters. So we see that the darkness is there. The face of the deep is there. What this implies, nobody is sure of, but we definitely know that it's not meaning that a corruption happened between verse 1 and verse 2. If you notice, I'm emphasizing that because I want to make it clear that I do not agree with the gap theory. I'm making myself clear on that one. Okay. I believe, and we'll talk about the day-age theory and the framework hypothesis in a little bit. I believe that these are, let me just tell you how I was before I was a believer. I believed in a God, but I didn't believe in the one true God. I was much like the people in the book of Acts chapter 17. And going to a public school and not having really a Christian foundation in a home, you were taught and you were basically demanded to believe in evolution. And they didn't force evolution down your throat. They basically said, this is all that there is. This is what you're going to have to believe. They didn't say, no, there is no God. There's no God. You don't have to believe in God because there is no God. They didn't say that. They just said that if there is a God, he's not needed because all you need is time, chance, a lot of situations, circumstances, all these things come together and poof, you have existence. So when people talk to me and they say, well, why don't you believe in evolution? I try and give them my testimony of, yeah, I was an evolutionist. Now I'm not an evolutionist. And I can't take what I used to be and apply that to the scriptures because it's going to contradict what the scriptures say. Some people can do that. And I find that most people who try and contradict the scriptures are believers. I don't find too many unbelievers that will try and fit evolution within the scriptures because they want evolution. Evolution says, I don't need a God. Evolution says, life will happen without a God. So the evolutionist doesn't have to take evolution and put it into the Bible. The believer does because we doubt the Word of God and we try and fit this evolutionary teaching within the scriptures when we don't have to. Let's go on. So the Spirit of God's moving. He's energizing the waters. He's putting in motion all of these things that we're going to see within chapter 1. So let's go on to verse 3. We'll read the first day. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. The first thing that jumps out to me concerning what I just spoke on, darkness. He doesn't say whether it's good or bad. He just says he distinguishes the light, calls it good, and he distinguishes from the darkness. He doesn't say whether darkness is good or bad. He just says it's there. And we have to just take it at that. So then God said, let there be light, and there was light. God, who is light, is the only one who can create light. The first day God speaks, which we could say is representing the Word of God, or Jesus Christ speaking things into existence, as John chapter 1 talks about. So we're seeing the representation of the Trinity, or this triune Godhead, which is spoken of in Elohim, which is the very first verse. And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. He's making a distinction here between two types of systems, the light and the darkness, which we would say is our photoperiod, the light and then the darkness. And he's creating an atmosphere or an environment for life to exist. He's given what they need as far as the light and then the darkness. How many of you believe that we need darkness as far as physical darkness? Some of us do, some of us don't. I think we do. It's hard for me to sleep if there's even a glimpse of light coming in my windows. I have to close my windows. I have to turn off all the lights. It's hard for me to sleep because I want total darkness when I'm sleeping. Again, darkness doesn't have to mean bad things. If we talk to a lot of kids, they say, well, I'm afraid of the dark. If we talk to some adults, even they would say, I'm afraid of the dark. I know of one person who had to sleep with a nightlight for many, many years. And finally, she understood that darkness was nothing to be afraid of, so now she doesn't have to have a nightlight. Now, my daughter, she still uses a nightlight. So he's just making a distinction. He's separating the light from the darkness. And he goes on, he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. In context, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, what is he meaning when he says day? Is he meaning a 24-hour cycle, or is he just meaning the period of light that we see, and we say, well, it's daytime or it's nighttime. In this context, it would be deemed as the daytime, the light. It's not meaning a 24-hour period. Darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Now we're going to talk about what he's meaning right here. And Ken Ham, he sums it up pretty good when he says, if you have these three things, it always means a 24-hour day. The evening, morning, a number, and it means a 24-hour day. And in the context, we're going to see how he ends his creative periods, these six 24-hour days. It always says, and the evening and the morning were a day, were the first day, were the second day, and it goes on. All right, let's go to another sidestep. We had the gap theory the first time, and now we're going to look at what is called the day-age theory. This one's probably not as familiar as the gap theory. Let's turn to 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as one day. And this is where the day-agers, they say, well, when you read the book of Genesis, it could possibly mean a literal 24-hour day when it says the first day. But it could also mean a long period of time. They're basically doing the same thing that the gap theory did, which is take the geologic timetable, this column that we see that is really not uniform throughout all of the earth that we have today, and they're saying, well, we're just going to put those. Well, this first layer of the geologic timetable is day one. And then how long was that? Well, it could be one day. It could be thousands of years. It could be millions of years. We're really not sure. All we do know is we see the fossil record. We got to put it somewhere because we're Christians, and we got to fit that somewhere. So now we're going to stretch out the creation week to thousands of years, millions of years, possibly even billions of years. And it really does not keep with the context of the Scriptures. If it was one day equals 1,000 years, then it's not being warranted in the Scriptures in chapter 1. Let's read it. And the evening and the morning were the first long period of time, possibly thousands of years. So it took thousands of years for God to make the light and separate it from the darkness. And then day two, it took him thousands of years to separate the firmament, the waters above and the waters below. We're not going to get there tonight. Let's go on. Day four. Well, let's go to day six. It took him thousands of years to create all the land animals and thousands of years to make all the human beings that we see. It just doesn't make sense. From a biblical point of view, from an evolutionary point of view, it makes absolute sense. But from a biblical point of view, it does not make sense when you're reading the Scriptures. So that's what it's saying. The days are long periods of time used to incorporate the evolutionary teaching of millions of years into the Scriptures. Another teaching is the framework hypothesis. And this is basically saying that you don't take the book of Genesis, specifically Genesis chapter 1, literally. It's just figurative. Adam is the head of the human race. He's not really necessarily a literal living human being. It's possible, but not really. And basically what the framework hypothesis is doing is saying, it's given an allowance for these long times of period, these periods of times, and it's incorporating evolution into the Scriptures. Can a believer believe in evolution and the Bible? Depends on who you ask. Yeah. Good answer. You can, but you're wrong. There are a lot of people like C.I. Schofield. I mean, who would doubt that he was a believer? I'm not. I didn't know him. I just have to go by what I read. He was in error on some things. A lot of us were in error on some things. I mean, that's just human nature. We comprehend things wrong sometimes. So can you be a believer and believe in evolution? You'd be wrong, but yes, you can. I think if you read the Scriptures outside of evolutionary thought, you would not accept evolution. You would not say that it's okay to believe it. You have to take it. What most people do, they take religion and they take science and they separate them. And for me as a believer, I don't do that. I take a relationship with Jesus Christ. I don't like to say religion. But I don't take my relationship with Jesus Christ and science and separate them. I put them together. They can intermingle. Henry Morris, which was basically the founder of modern-day creationism, he didn't start it, but he gave it to us so that we could better understand it. He was a godly, you could call him a theologian if you wanted to. He understood the Scriptures, but he was also a scientist with a bunch of little initials at the end of his name. A very brilliant man. So you can take both of them and put them together. The question is, do you have to take evolutionary thought and say that that's science and then put that together? We have to distinguish between them. Some closing comments on these, and then next week we'll pick up on some of the other days. Why do we need to alter the simple literal meaning of evening, morning, number equals a 24-hour day? And basically, a faulty assumption that the geologic column is correct, faulty assumption that the carbon dating is correct, faulty assumption that the fossil evidence is interpreted correctly. I've been influenced by Ken Ham a great deal, as you probably can tell by when I talk about him. And the evidence is the same, as he would say. We look at the same evidence. We have the fossil record there. How do we interpret it? My interpretation of the fossil record is going to be based on the scriptures. Fossil record came because of death. Death came because of sin. Sin came because Adam and Eve made a choice. God allowed that choice. The catastrophe didn't happen between Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It happened in Genesis chapter 3. The books of Jeremiah and Isaiah that T.I. Schofield and a lot of these other people use to proclaim the gap theory, if you use those in context, these are future events that are going to be taking place after Jeremiah's time, after Isaiah's time. It's not talking about a past event that happened in the primeval time period. It's talking about an event that's going to happen way after that. So we're seeing that if you take things in context and you look at the scriptures, can you believe in evolution? If you don't take the scriptures in context, you can. If you look at evolutionary science and you say that this is the one true science and this is what I'm going to build my foundation on, since I've been a believer and been studying evolution and creation, evolution has changed its thoughts so many times, even since I've been in school. We started off with a Big Bang. We started off with all of these other concepts of how life began. And all of them left out God, but all of them continue to change. Uniformitarianism is one of them. And then you have, what do they call that one? Punctuated equilibrium. Slow process, bang, it speeds up. Slow process, bang, it speeds up. That's what that means. Well, none of the fossil record lines up with that, so they have to keep on changing. If they would just look at the scriptures and say, hey, God created it, how did he create it? Well, we can get a glimpse of how he created it, but we don't know fully what he did. All we do know now is that what he created in the beginning, and we'll talk about this as we go through the chapters, what he created in the beginning is not what we see today. And that's the catastrophe, the cataclysm, the destruction that we see today. When God finished his creation, everything was perfect, everything was lovely, everything was without corruption or anything. But after that, things happened that caused me to have to wear glasses, people to lose their hair, and ultimately people to die. Die physically and die spiritually. So that's the catastrophe that we need to be looking at, not some supposed gap theory that are taking bits and pieces of scriptures that is really not kosher with the scriptures, if you want to say it like that. And the day-age theory and the framework hypothesis is two others. There's many other examples. And basically all they're saying is, evolution's right, we have to fit it in the scriptures. And I'm saying evolution is wrong, we don't need it in the scriptures. We don't even need it in our lives. We just don't need it. So we'll end there and pick up next week.